Hello and welcome to the Let's Talk Bipolar podcast, hosted by Emma Bell and brought to you by Bipolar UK. You can find all of our resources at www.bipolaruk.org. This week, I have got my guest on called Sam Swiderski, and he released a book last year, Winning the War Within. And you have bipolar, don't you?
Yes, I do have a diagnosis of bipolar. Yeah, it's obviously a very difficult road. It's not an easy thing to have to deal with. But I think it's one of those things that, you know, given enough time, given the right treatment, it's possible to be able to manage. I really do believe that.
I completely agree.
Yeah, I believe that the outcomes can be really, really positive. And I think that despite it being one of the most, you know, serious, you know, mental illnesses, and you know, out of all of them, I think that you know, we can have really good outcomes, which is a very positive thing.
I completely agree. So Sam, before we get into your story and how you have come to be an author, please can you tell us a little bit about you, where you're from, a little bit about your kind of background, your upbringing, and then we'll go into talking about how you came to learn that you were living with bipolar and what that part of your journey has been like.
Okay, so I guess, I had quite an unusual upbringing in a way. I was brought up as a Jehovah's Witness. Okay. And, you know, very, very, you know, strong Jehovah's Witness family that, you know, very, very much religious. And I was quite outcast from society in a lot of ways as a result. Like I wasn't really supposed to have like friends in school and different things. You know, so I was quite a loner, and I think I was always naturally quite a loner, but no one really worried about me. No one really worried about me because I was very just sort of head in the books type of person. I think that people thought, okay, you know, he's going to do really well. He's going to be fine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess I hit a certain age. I hit about 16 years old, and that's when problems really started getting quite bad. Mm-hmm. You know, I started having periods of very much high elated mood where I'd, you know, have these grandiose delusions, things that I can do, really awesome things that I can do in my life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'd struggle to sleep. I'd have, you know, I'd struggle to eat because it was just too much angst and excitement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, an anger and an irritability sort of started to begin, and it impacted upon my relationships and lots of different things. And I just had these, you know, intense periods of highs, and these periods of highs would followed by these low periods where mm-hmm. I'd, you know, feel completely worthless, you know, suicidal at parts, and just, you know, no pleasure or lack of interest in anything. And for quite a while, you know, I was having these ups and downs. Mm-hmm. And you know, it just sort of became quite, I realized there was something wrong, but I didn't want to accept it, essentially. Okay. And then I hit about 18 and I decided, okay, I'm gonna try and seek some help. And sadly, the mental health services weren't very good with responding, and it, you know, they were going to take quite a while to be able to give me the right care. Mm-hmm. Within the UK, we've got sort of a thing where you know, there's a period between when you're a youth and an adult in terms of mental health services. Mm-hmm. And because I was trying to access it at the age of 18, it was quite complex because I was going from youth service to adult service. So mm-hmm. there was quite a lot of a wait. Mm-hmm. But then during that period of time, a lot of things went wrong. I mean, my sister was diagnosed with leukemia and she was most likely gonna, you know, pass on. I decided to spend my time running to raise money for leukemia and lymphoma research because mm-hmm. I really wanted to do something for my sister. Mm-hmm. But I ended up getting a bad injury because I was overtraining. Typical sort of hypomanic way of going about things, like overtraining, mm-hmm. You know, constantly on the go.
Yeah, I do know.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. Yeah, it can get disastrous
it absolutely can. Yeah, it can. Yeah. Although we feel like it's completely infallible at the time, it really can be very disastrous lots of the time, right? So tell me more.
Yeah, so you know, a number of things was going wrong, and then after that, my girlfriend at the time left me, and then that was another stressor and another trigger for me. And yeah, so I ended up having a really severe, what I now realize was a mixed episode. I had to be seen by professionals. I was put into a psychosis unit, and they were unsure on how to diagnose me. They weren't really sure.
Because you were presenting in this mixed state?
Yes.
Okay.
Because I didn't clearly fit into the
one or the other
depression.
Uh-huh. Can you elaborate a bit more for the people listening on a mixed state? Because I've done another podcast with a guy, and we've spoken about depression, hypomania, and when we go into a manic phase. And I've only ever had a mixed state once in my life, but I'd love to hear it from you and how that showed up for you.
Yeah, I think it's really important. I'm glad that you asked that question, because it's only really in recent years that doctors have been giving that much attention to mixed states. Mm-hmm. And essentially what it is where you meet the criteria for mania and depression at the same time. So you have this elation, you have this excitement, you've got this drive in some respects, and this mainly anger and irritability. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, though, you've got no energy, you feel worthless. And it's like this oxymoron, this impossible sort of combination of these two opposite things.
Mm-hmm.
And often you feel them at the same time, but then sometimes there's like switches between the two. So it's very destabilizing in a way, mm-hmm. Incredibly destabilizing. And essentially, you know, I think that during mixed episodes is the periods where I felt most suicidal, because you feel all of those negative things of depression, of, you know, no self-worth, you know, I might as well end it all, with mm-hmm. also the negative side of the mania. So the irritability, the struggle to sleep, because you're too on the go all the time.
Yeah, completely wired.
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah.
And so I'd say that, you know, even though mixed episodes have only really been talked about within the literature for a small number of years now, mm-hmm. even the people like back then, like 10 so years ago, they didn't know how to look at the mixed states. But I've been, because I'm doing a PhD in bipolar disorder, and I've been looking at the history of mixed states, and it turns out that mixed states have been recognized since the ancient Greeks. It's been documented since the first century, and yeah, I was very surprised by that, actually. So I'm not really entirely sure why a lot of clinicians don't really know much about mixed states. So I'm very much glad that you asked that question, because it's an area which needs to have more work in.
I just don't think it's spoken about enough. That and rapid cycling, I feel, are the sort of least spoken about kind of, as mental illness and bipolar has become more spoken about mainstream, I think people are becoming more and more familiar with terms like suicidal, depressive state, manic state, hypermanic state. I think people are now starting to, you know, understand. People used to just kind of see the two polar opposites, right? And now they're seeing the hypermanic part of it. And then there's these other parts in between, the rapid cycling, the mixed states, and they're even less understood and less spoken about. So I'm loving talking to you about this. In this way.
No, thank you. And I'll go into rapid cycling as well, because you mentioned it's a very important aspect. Mm-hmm. Essentially, the diagnostic criteria when they talk about rapid cycling, it's when you have four switches in mood within any given year. Mm-hmm. That's how they diagnose someone as having rapid cycling. So, you know, if you have one manic episode, one depressive episode, one, you know, hypermanic episode, one depressive mm-hmm. episode,
mm-hmm.
and then so on. Essentially, you just need four switches between mm-hmm. between the periods, and then that can be categorized as rapid cycling. But mm-hmm. most people, the way that they experience rapid cycling is that is a lot faster than that, even. And so you can have maybe 4 or 5 days in one, and then you're just sort of going like this over a period of time, and so that's how a lot of people experience rapid cycling. And essentially rapid cycling is really bad because, you know, imagine being pulled in different directions really, really fast all the time. The main sort of effect of that long term is that, you know, if you're always having these cycles, you forget who you are in the middle, essentially.
Completely agree.
And you know, you get used to these highs and lows, and it becomes who you are, and isn't actually who you are, but it is what you start to define who you are. And I think that this is where the whole term comes from, when people start to say, I am bipolar. Personally, I don't agree with that. Using that terminology,
I say I live with bipolar.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's a lot better way of putting it.
How do you say it for you?
I personally say I have bipolar disorder.
Yeah.
So that's the way that I.
Yeah. Rather than I am bipolar, because I'm Emma, right? And I live with bipolar. Yeah. I'm not bipolar living with Emma, although maybe sometimes, you know, when I'm not feeling well, but it could feel a bit like that. But actually, technically, I'm Emma and I live with bipolar. I have to cohabit with bipolar and I have to make friends with bipolar, because guess what? We live together. And that's kind of how I talk about it for myself. So I'm always interested to hear how other people talk about it. And when people have interviewed me, it is like, you're bipolar, like I am bipolar, or, you know, this.
Yeah. Yes. Mm. So, you know, and, you know, I totally agree with your line of reasoning there, because I think that, you know, I've got a chapter in my book called Know Yourself, you know your illness and know the difference between the two.
Yes.
So essentially, the illness doesn't define who we are. We are a person in the middle. And I remember the reason why I wrote that chapter and the reason why I feel so passionate about this is I sat in a CBT room, and we essentially, he gave me a worksheet to write down what I'm like when manic, what I'm like when depressed, and what I'm like when stable. And I found it almost impossible to write what I'm like when I'm stable.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really remember who that person was at all.
Mm-hmm.
And a big part of my recovery journey was remembering who that person was, because, you know, you need to know who you are. You need to know who you are as a person. And these high and low moods that you go through are a disorder. It's something that is part of your experience, but it doesn't define you.
No. And I love that you said that, because one of the things that I say a lot is, know the difference between your mental health condition and your conditioning, and how one affects the other, and one can trigger the other, and you can end up in this perpetual cycle of one triggering the other. And until you start to understand what your triggers are for your mental health condition and what your triggers are for your conditioning that in turn trigger you to be unwell, you can end up in this loop. So understanding these is critical. If for me, that's what I believe. I think it's critical to a long-term recovery plan to be as stable as we can be.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's one of the most important things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that you make that distinction, and, you know, about how the one impacts the other and the opposite way around as well. You know, I think that's an important way of looking at it, because it can really help to improve.
Like, I live with bipolar, you live with bipolar, but our upbringings were entirely different. Right, we're born in England, raised in England, and we both live with bipolar, but my conditioning in terms of how I react to stress through my conditioning, not my mental health condition, will be entirely different to how you are wired through your childhood conditioning to respond to stress. Now, all of these things are exasperated and exaggerated when we live with bipolar, obviously. But if we can't unpick, we need to unpick those things to really kind of get into the intricacies of who we are, where we've come from, and how that shows up in our mental health condition, illness, and health when we start to get stable, right?
Yeah, I think that managing stress is vital. Understanding how we currently manage stress is really important, and I think that can help us in terms of understanding where we need to improve. But I think that, you know, the biggest triggers for bipolar episodes, as I'm sure that you know very well, is big changes, and they just can be negative or positive.
Yes, you know, they can.
Yeah, like big changes. I can't deal with a birthday party if it's a surprise. I like a birthday party, but if it's a surprise, I can't actually deal with it because I'm just like, I don't know. It, for some weird reason, I think that a lot of us that suffer from this disorder, we just any sort of surprise or any sort of shock can sort of, can destabilize us a lot. So it's important to have that self-awareness and realize especially which changes really impact upon us.
Yeah, and you're right, it doesn't have to be just negative changes. It can be even the good stuff. If there's too much good stuff coming at once, that can be very triggering for me to go into a hypomanic state, and obviously left unchecked, where could it end up? So it is changes, and not good or bad, just changes that are too much of a shift sometimes in one direction or another. You're completely right.
Yeah, and you know, I think that it's important to create awareness around that. Really important, because essentially if we understand our triggers, then we know when to step in. You know, we can step in as soon as we have a trigger, even before we see early symptoms. And the earlier we step in, the more likely we are to not fall into episode.
So you went to, let's go back to the part where you were trying to get help and you're at this kind of transitional age and you're in a mixed state. So talk me through that next part of your journey.
So essentially, the professionals didn't really know what to do with me, and I received not very great care for quite a while. Essentially, I was under-medicated and then I was severely over-medicated. And as a result, I decided to then, following this, come off my medication entirely, which left me in the worst state of my life. Like I felt so, you know, it was a really bad mixed state. I felt so confused and also so incredibly in pain that I felt like there was only, you know, two options in life, essentially. One of them was to end it all for myself, or to essentially go around like a crazy villain and essentially just be like a horrible villain in the world. And essentially I decided that, you know, it would be best to end my life. I believe that was the right choice for me to make at the time. Fortunately, I'm still alive, which I'm very glad about. And I was very lucky, because essentially following that, I managed to be in contact with a great psychiatrist, a research psychiatrist, who helped me to get better. I started to participate in research trials at King's College, just mainly, to be honest, to just get some money more than anything. But I was just very lucky and fortunate to meet researchers there who really cared about bipolar and really cared about me, it seemed. And it was the first time that I felt cared for and appreciated by mental health professionals. And, you know, I was really lucky, because not only did they care, but, you know, they were also some of the most senior people in bipolar in the country. And that was just really good luck, to be honest. I wish that more people would get good luck like that. But he helped me to find a psychiatrist, which would actually be able to help me very well. And, you know, be experimented with medication for a little bit. And then I finally found the right medication for me. And then essentially things stabilized, and since then I've been pretty well. But essentially the lack of stability for a long period of time left me in a state of where I couldn't do anything. I couldn't leave the house, I couldn't work, I couldn't study, I couldn't look after myself, I couldn't even read a page of text. Essentially, I think especially rapid cycling was a big part of this, because it affects your cognition a lot. It affects the way you're able to think about things. And essentially, like I just lost the ability to be able to remember things as soon as I do them.
And
it was really difficult. And a big part of my journey was trying to learn from there. How do I come back? How do I start to function again?
Mm-hmm. The rapid cycling part is, I find, really interesting. I suppose if I look at my history, I could have been classed in rapid cycling many times, actually, throughout the 2 decades or whatever that it's been affecting my life. But in particular, when I got put on a wrong medication, I felt like I was in rapid cycling for weeks, and I was doing the cycle 4 or 5 times in a day, and it was incredibly acute and incredibly stressful. I would go from spending like 2 hours bouncing off the walls to 2 or 3 hours literally terrified, making sure that I was inside with the doors locked for fear of, I didn't feel safe. I knew I live in a tower in the middle of Dubai, and I had to make sure that I was in with the door shut, because I just couldn't trust myself to not go and take myself off the edge of the balcony. And I literally just had to sit there and think, because this had been happening for, you know, days and weeks by this point, I knew that in a couple of hours I wouldn't feel like that. But it was for those few hours, I literally had to just kind of sit still and bunker down and wait for it to pass, to feel good again, so that I could feel safe, that I wouldn't do something erratic and end my own life through this chaotic cycling of mood that really was so intense. And it was wrong medication, actually, that caused that. And I came off the medication, and, you know, very quickly that went. But it shows me how critical medication is, because it can trigger a very unwell state that you wouldn't normally have gone into on your own without that medication being introduced. Just because someone gives you medication doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be the right one for you. And it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to suddenly, you know, magic, abracadabra, fix everything. That's just not how this stuff works. Everything different for different people. And so anyway, that's my experience of rapid cycling. And it was frightening for me. I mean, if I think about it in the terms that you've said, 4 states in a year, I have probably rapid cycled often. But for me, when I hear rapid cycling, all I can think about was those weeks where I was in that state, and it was exhausting. I was like a permanently, you know, have you ever seen that? And I don't know if you call them memes or memes, you'll know, but, you know, and it's like, I feel like a permanently exhausted pigeon. That was me, because I wasn't getting any respite. Even through the night, I would be 2 hours, 2 hours, 2 hours. It was constant and it was exhausting. My body didn't know which way it was going to go, and there was no way I could have retained any information during those weeks.
That sounds like really, really intense.
No way.
It's difficult to categorize that in terms of how to diagnose that, but I feel like that's an interesting, I wonder whether that would actually fall into the category of a mixed state,
really.
Because of quite how fast that is in terms of the changes.
Mm-hmm.
But I can see, you know, if 12 weeks of that, I mean, that sounds, you know, horrendous to have that long of constant changes. But, you know, you mentioned as well in terms of the medication.
Mm.
Different medications are going to be different for other people. And it sort of reminded me as well, because the Razadone, you know, for anyone that's got bipolar listening to this, is known to be now one of the best medications in terms of current research. Like, current research is really positive about it, because they say it's not really got many side effects at all, and that it's good for both the highs and the lows. But for me, I took it purely for that reason, and as soon as I take it for half an hour, I had severe levels of irritability, to the point that I was absolutely terrified of taking it. I'd need to pace. I had severe anxiety and irritability at the same time. And I genuinely feel like suicidal during that period of 30 minutes. And then for the rest of the whole day, I'd feel completely fine. and I'd have a really good night's sleep, and I was I was fine. So it was very strange, because it really did help me, but it just, I had that strange side effect for half an hour after taking it. And apparently, like, some people have that effect, but it's very rare. So it just shows you, like, you know, different medications work for different people, but once you find the ones that are good for you, things are a lot better.
They are, yeah, I completely agree. And I know now what I need if I'm in X state, or I know what works for me. You know, 10 years after being diagnosed, I now know what's my go-to, what will work, what won't work. And it just takes time, and it's, and I find it, you know, my heart kind of hurts for people when they're going through that period of finding what works for them, because it can be so, it's such a delicate space to be in. And it can be a really risky space to be in until people really find what works for them, because some medications can kind of make things a bit worse before they make them a bit better. And it's just a hard bit to get through. Do you know what I mean? Until you find your groove. And then things do, for me anyway, got a bit easier.
Yeah, and yeah, I think that that's the hardest thing, and I think that that's where a lot of the anti-psychs come from, anti-psychiatrists, people who are very, you know, negative towards medications, because a lot of them, you know, they try the medication route, and then it can be painful, you know, it can make things a lot worse. And then it's interesting, because I did mood graphs. I was doing a tutorial, and I was drawing my own mood graphs to show to people, and I realized that following starting to take medication, the highs were better, but the lows were worse for quite a long time, because the medication for me was too sedative, and that led me to have quite negative mood. And it took me a while to find the right medication. And also, patience is important, because like you said, sometimes when you first start taking medication, it's, you know, the effects aren't good. The effects can be very negative, because you're not quite used to them yet, and then that patience is sort of needed to wait for it to get a little bit better. But
the patient bit is hard, though, if the side effect is making you erratic in your behavior. So for me, the lesson I learned was, don't just keep doggedly carrying on suffering. It's not working, right? And for me, if it was having that an erratic effect that essentially was bringing risk to my life and probably other people's lives, then we don't need to keep going and just, you know, maybe we just need a change, right? And yeah, so it's a fine balance, isn't it, between giving the medication a good enough go and not going on so long that you keep suffering unnecessarily, when there could be another medication out there that would be much easier, much softer for you, and you'd be feeling a lot better, a lot quicker. So I think it's really difficult. Patience is absolutely key, but it's also, I can see the difficulty in it when, especially if somebody is suicidal, being erratic, bringing risk to their lives and others. And that's where the support around you is key, or reaching out is key, or, you know, using these free support groups, forums to kind of lean on, because you need all the help you can get while you're stabilizing. You need that.
Yeah, 100%. And yeah, I think that you strike a really good point there on the balance between the patience and the recognition that this med might not be right for you. The way that I sort of go with it, because very similar to you, I think that if the medication is causing you to have things on the high end, I think that it's you just straight up should not be taking that. You know, if it's causing you to be erratic, if it's causing you to be overly irritable, if it's causing those things on the high, I think that straight up that medication is not good for you. I think that if it's causing you to be sedated, and the main effects are more like lethargy and just like just struggling to get up and those types of things, those types of symptoms tend to pass with a bit of time. Whereas in terms of the things that cause like the erratic highs, I think that's the worst type of medication to be on, probably.
Yeah. And and you're right, like the sedating ones, I was on antipsychotics for the first 2 or 3 years after being diagnosed, and I felt nothing. Like I was like zombie nothing. Didn't feel happy, didn't feel sad, didn't feel anything, just like flatline. Boop. Yeah. Now, that saved my life, probably saved the lives of people around me too, because I was not acting rationally at all. I was really out of control. And it saved my life, but I was like dead inside, you know? Yeah. And then it was only once I was able to do that and almost flatline for a while, and then go and step into therapy, and then go and start learning other tools, and then start unpicking my childhood of origin stuff, that I was able to kind of build a toolkit so that I could come off of the heavier drugs onto something not so heavy, because I had other ways to cope. I didn't need to be, you know, sort of kept in this much control, because I could now sort of ebb and flow a little bit, because I had extra tools in my kit to cope with the ebb and flow that came with not being completely flatlining, right? But wouldn't have changed those 2 or 3 years on antipsychotics, because wouldn't be alive without them. They were a necessary step in my path to stability, to have safety where I wasn't being erratic, to kind of unlearn and relearn some stuff.
So if you don't mind me asking, like, what are you taking right now?
So I'm not on anything now.
Mm.
But that doesn't mean that it's not in my toolkit to go to. So I have had periods where I've not been okay. And I know now, I go in, I know exactly what I need, and I go to it. And it's normally when I'm getting triggered around, like, events are going on in life. I'm undergoing fertility treatment at the moment, which is why I've chosen to go down a medication-free path while I do this part of my journey. But the truth is, once I've finished IVF and once I've come out the other side of that, it's harder for me to live a stable life without my medication. Mm. I have to work. It's like laborious. I know, but I can do it, right? But I have to really put so much extra insulation around me to be able to achieve it, if that makes any sense. Like, I have to make sure I'm padded like Michelin Man, you know, to do it with no medication. And I know that I need to allow myself an extra kind of 40% grace with every area of my life to cope. The truth is, I'm looking forward to getting through IVF. I'm looking forward to going through my pregnancy, coming out the other side, hopefully. I've had a lot of loss and that, but I'm looking forward to being able to go back on my medication, is the truth, because it is 20 to 30% easier for me to live a stable life without having to constantly manage myself.
Yes.
It's kind of exhausting.
I mean, and that's a beautiful, like, because the thing is, when I was writing the book, I decided that the main theme that I wanted to get across to people was that managing bipolar needs to be the number one most important thing in your life. Mm-hmm. And that there's no aspect of this disorder which you should, you should is quite a harsh word, mm-hmm. but that is a good idea to rest on and mm-hmm. and to rely on and enjoy, because a lot of people rest on those hypomanic periods.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been there. I'm sure that pretty much anyone that with bipolar has been there.
We've all ridden those waves.
Yeah.
Thought we were invincible. Thought we were Superman. We've all done it.
Exactly. All done it. Exactly, and it's just realizing that those waves aren't worth anything is the most important realization. And I thought that was really, really cool and awesome that you just said that you sort of look forward to going back on medication, because I think that's a really important piece of awareness to put out there, that medication is not a bad thing. it's a very good thing. It helps keep things within that normal realm. And you know, but at the same time, I must say that it's very admirable that you're managing to keep things together despite being on medication. I think that you deserve a lot of respect for that.
But it's the difference between holding on to, here's how I can describe it for me. I feel like I've been practicing and learning tools for a decade to do this. Now, take me about 5 years. There's no way I could have entertained it, right? But it's like being on an inflatable Lilo on the ocean, holding on for dear life, and the sea so choppy, but I've got enough tools and strength that I can kind of hold on, and I'm sort of white knuckle riding it, if that makes sense. Yeah. With the medication, I can let go a little bit and I can kind of look up and enjoy the view. And yeah, there's a few waves, but I can kind of just bob over them. And that's the way I can describe how I feel managing my bipolar on a day-to-day basis, medication versus no medication. I can do it. But if you could imagine being out in the sea for 3 hours, just casually just bobbing across some nice waves with a nice view versus 3 hours holding on for dear life, having to watch every little crest of wave that comes. Is it going to knock me off? Have I got right? And I need to rebalance here. I need to put my weight here just to stay on top. That's the difference for me.
Yeah. And but you know, it's still admirable and it's still amazing that you're able to do that. But I think at the same time, it's a good, you know, point for other people to take on as well, that just because some people are able to manage without taking medication doesn't mean that it's the easier path.
It's not. For me, it's not. It's just what I'm choosing to do right now because of another thing, which isn't going to be a lifelong thing going on. I've kind of decided that I would like to explore that. But equally, I have my psychiatrist on standby that if I get to a point where I can't cope, I know where I'm going, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not out there on my own. There's a lifeguard waiting for me very close by. I just need to go get him.
Yeah.
You know? No,
I think it's amazing though that you've done this and you've created your toolkit and everything. And, you know, I think you'll be quite interested to hear exactly, because I've got my book here. Essentially the steps which I discuss within here, which I personally use and which I, you know, think that would really greatly help other people as well with bipolar. I thought, you know, essentially just to go through like a quick run through of, I guess, the tips that I generally give.
I'd love to hear it. First of all, can you say the name of your book, the title, for everyone that's not watching on YouTube that will just be listening?
Okay, so it's Winning the War with Bipolar. So it's, yeah, I like the title. I like the picture that comes with it. My graphic design is really, really, really great. I feel very fortunate to have met him. It was a pleasure writing. It was one of those things that stick my head down because we were in lockdown and I was like, okay.
How long did it take you to write?
So it took me about 3 months to write it. But
and how many pages, like, tell me, like, you took you about 3 months, and how many pages did you write?
220 ish pages. So it was about 50 something thousand words.
Wowzers.
Yeah, but I mean, if anyone wants to write a book, the one piece of advice that I'd give is from Ernest Hemingway, and it's that, you know, you've just got to write. You know, I can't remember the exact phrase that he used, but you just have to write, and then the organization will come later. Uh-huh. The only reason that writer's block happens, and the only reason why people struggle to write books, uh-huh, is because they become too perfectionist about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's literally the only reason why it happens. That's the only reason why writer's block happens. You just need to write, and, you know, essentially, you know, you might write 2,000 words in a day, and not a single word might go into your book.
Mm-hmm.
But the process of writing those 2,000 words will teach you something about what needs to go in the book.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you. Yeah. I am in the process of writing, and it's not a book about specifically bipolar, just different things. So I love to hear other people's experiences of writing their own book. So thank you for sharing that with me.
Yeah, no worries. I think that it's an amazing thing to do. I'd say that there's ups and downs in the process of, you know, because obviously it's a very difficult process, but at the same time, as long as you keep that in mind, I think that writing a book can be quite simple. But in terms of going through this,
tell me.
So essentially I divided it into four sections, and because I think that these were the four most important things that I needed to do in terms of developing, I guess, my toolkit to be able to manage bipolar. So first off, I discuss what is bipolar disorder. So I discuss essentially the diagnostic criteria and how all of those things actually manifest in real life, because it's easy to look at the diagnostic criteria, and it's very helpful to look at you know, resources out there which show cases of, you know, and you know, essentially people talking about their own experience. But I think what I did quite nicely was I described essentially the two at the same time. So I described, you know, I listed the criteria and then showed what I was like, you know, in a manic or a depressive episode to meet that criteria. So, you know, and then I just, you know, busted some myths and things like that about bipolar, you know, some common things, you know, reasonably simple stuff, you know, to get started. So I did sort of deep dive into what it is. Then I discussed like how to make therapy work, because, you know, and essentially like the key principles there on how to make therapy work. And I think that some of the biggest things that people struggle with therapy with is the having the right reasons to go, for starters, being able to choose a therapist or have a therapist that you have a good rapport with, and, you know, and the ways that you can sort of manage that, because that's really important. And I want to actually talk about this a little bit more, because I think that it's really important in terms of rapport, because if you want to have a good rapport with your therapist, it's not just about liking your therapist. You've also got to be able to be open with them. And I think that that's one of the most important things. And essentially, if you're, you know, you struggle to open up to a man, for example, about certain things, maybe because of, you know, certain abuse in some sort of part of your life, then, you know, from a male figure or the opposite way around, then probably not best to choose a therapist from that line, just purely because, you know, you need to choose someone that you're going to be able to be open with.
Well, and also, and you're giving yourself an extra hurdle to get across, right? You're there to talk about stuff, but then you've also got to get across the hurdle, the fact that you're triggered by a man because you've previously got this experience, this trauma, this trigger that's showing up for you. So before you can even access a therapy, you've got to get across this hurdle, which you really ideally need the therapist to help you unpack. So it's kind of really not helpful.
Yeah, definitely, 100%.
Yeah.
and it can go the other way as well, in terms of, you know, for one of the first therapists I had, I mentioned this in the book, but I was very attracted to her. I couldn't help it. Like especially because you know what it's like with bipolar, because you have like the, like,
the rose tinted glasses are on.
Yeah, essentially. And yeah, even though I enjoy talking to her a lot, I can be fully open because I was only 18 or so as well.
Oh, this
so,
is brilliant. Yeah. It's like you can go the other way. You can just be intimidated for them because you're quite attracted to them. That's not helpful either.
Yeah, so essentially you just need to find someone that you're able to be open with.
This
and
brilliant.
Honest.
I hadn't thought about that before, but it's a very good point.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really awkward because I was in the hypomanic episode as well. So when I look back at those sessions, it was really awkward. But it's
super keen bean.
Yeah.
Oh gosh. Okay. Good point. Okay, noted.
So yeah, that's sort of in terms of rapport. Sorry, I want to remember other points. Oh yeah, don't go in the midst of an episode. That is really vital. You know, when, you know, it's always best to do therapy when we're feeling well, isn't it?
I agree.
And you know, this backed up by loads of research. And
is it? I didn't know that. It's just come from my own experience. Like I have a couple of friends who have been suffering with depression and anxiety, and they, you know, like I've seen them kind of scrambling for therapy first, and I say to them, I'm loving to hear that you're saying it's backed up by research, which is great. but I've said to them, if you are, you can't, it's almost like you haven't got the capacity to do the processing, to do the talk therapy, to be cognizant of what you're saying when you are really, really unstable. And medication can help you to find that stability, which then gives you the space where you're not completely strung out, over capacity, flooded, emotionally overwhelmed, all of those things, to actually do the work. Because therapy isn't a magic wand. It can be very hard work, and it's emotional labor. And if you are already completely maxed out and you're already way over capacity, you're drowning, how on earth can you then go in and expect yourself to emotionally labor again? You know, I love that you've said that. I'm so pleased you've said that.
Yeah. And it's very true. And for precisely the points that you just made, like, you know, that's what sort of the research has shown. So it's good that you sort of intuitively came to the
just
same.
It's just my experience of it, you know, like we can't get dry if we're in the middle of the sea drowning, you know, like we can't start toweling ourselves down and figuring out how we got wet when we're still drowning. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, very
We need to get to shore first and like at least dry off a foot, you know. I've got one dry foot, let's start there. You know, not when we're like gulping for air, drowning, because that's how depression and that felt for me, like drowning.
Exactly. And the thing is, but what happens when you go into depression is the therapy becomes a you know, something that you latch on to be able to cope week by week, which for some people it might be important at that particular time. Really important, in fact. But the thing is, like, if you really want to have long lasting change, you need to have a period of therapy when you're feeling better, when you're stable, because then you can really develop, as you say, the toolkits that you need to use going forward.
It's about capacity, right?
Yeah.
And often when we're in a state of being very unwell, whether that be low or high, mixed, whatever, there isn't the emotional capacity to do the laborious work that is therapy. Now, you're right, therapy in itself, just turning up to that session, can be a lifeline. Like, there's someone there, there's someone here that I'm keeping me accountable, that I'm showing up for, you know, that I've basically hung on all week, even though I'm suicidal, I'm just hanging on for that session. So there's more uses for these sessions than just the therapy. But to really feel the benefit of the therapy itself, we have to have some capacity to do the work. Now, if those therapy sessions for you are keeping you alive, like, you keep doing that, right? for sure, because if there's a benefit, there's a benefit. But you're right, the long-lasting benefit for me certainly came when I had the capacity to have the space to do the processing.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, you need that space. You need that capacity, as you say, and it's vital. You know, and as you say, I think that's really where medication comes through, and in the importance of that as well. So I think those are sort of the main points that I made in terms of, you know, obviously I've got some more, but in terms of how to make therapy work, I also like to use this phrase that the relationship between a therapist and a client is like that of a teacher and a pupil. So, or a teacher and a, you know, and you know, a tutor and a pupil, should I say, really, because it's a one-to-one relationship. But the teacher's job isn't to do the exams for the student, and the students don't do the exam while they're sitting there with the tutor. You know, it's you're there as the pupil, or as the, you know, as the service user using a service to learn things which you can apply to real life situations. And, you know, it's your job to essentially, when you're attending therapy, to take in the things that you're learning and to actually apply it to real life. And that's where things like homework come in, is where therapy blueprints come in, all of these types of things which are supposed to try and help you to actually apply these things and add them to, as you say, the toolkit. Because you're trying to learn these toolkits, you know, the tools within the toolkit, within that therapy environment, and it's important.
I agree. So What is there anything else that you'd like to share from your book while we're chatting?
Well, I mean, following this, I just like you, I go through a section which is becoming your own psychologist, and it's just essentially like the tools that I've sort of learned specifically on my journey, and then at the end I discuss like consistency and the importance of consistency, and finding that, and you know, like the things that we said earlier, you know, making the decision to you know, stay, for example, on a medication, being consistent in that way, deciding to stay, like, you know, trying to find what you really want to do so that you're following the same passion all the time rather than constantly switching, all of these different things, ways of becoming consistent as a human being. I think that's so important in the journey with bipolar, because bipolar can often take you into a million different directions, and finding that way to stay consistent and stay on task is really important. So yeah, that's really just an overview of the book, I guess.
And I'd love to, where can we buy your book, first of all? Can you share that with us? Where could someone get a copy of your book?
So it's on Amazon. So it's on Amazon. It will be uploaded actually to Audible as well in March. So there's going to be.
I'm an Audible girl, so I'll be on that.
A lot of people are these days.
It's great. You can do it while you're getting ready, while you're doing this. It's just super easy when you're driving, you know. So I'll be a customer in March when it comes out on Audible. I will be buying it and listening.
Cool, thank you. And I think that it will be enjoyed, and I enjoyed the process. I mean, I
and are you narrating it?
Yeah, I narrated it, and I was very lucky to have my friend who's a great editor. He helped me because he's my friend. He did it at a low price, which I feel quite bad for, but he did a really good job, amazing job. So I was really pleased with that. I'm just sort of waiting for them to approve it at the moment.
Oh, how exciting! Officially. Well, you've got one Audible customer waiting eagerly. That's me.
it's fun. I'd say the process of doing a book is fun.
So the last thing I'd like to ask you is two things. Could you tell me a little bit more about the research work that you're doing and the most interesting part of it for you? And the other thing is, just where are you now with your own bipolar journey? How long do you feel you've kind of, and I know we can never be 100% stable, but how long do you feel like you've been in a groove, for your own groove, where you kind of know yourself, you kind of know what works, what doesn't? Tell us a bit about that.
Okay. I mean, I guess, I'll start with the first question first. So the main area that I look at is cognition in bipolar disorder, because as I said, you know, I was motivated to do this because I lost the ability to read a page of text, and I slowly was able to learn how to now write a book and pursue a PhD. Like, that's really weird to me. Like, I thought I wouldn't be able to do anything, and I wouldn't be able to like ever read a book. And then now I've written one. It's quite weird, really. If I was able to look back on that self and tell that person, they wouldn't believe me. So essentially trying to work out how to help people to become more cognitively able again within bipolar. So the most interesting things about this is that, firstly, people with bipolar disorder naturally have got, on average, much higher cognitive ability than the average person, which is very, very strange for, in comparison to other psychosis related disorders, like schizophrenia has got considerably lower than average, or, you know, but bipolar's got considerably above. And because of that, sadly, a lot of people aren't interested in measuring cognition in bipolar disorder, because they just think, okay, this group's all right. But the problem is that there's a dramatic drop in cognitive ability in people with bipolar disorder following episodes of illness. So people are naturally very high in things like IQ, like, you know, language, different things. But then over time, because of the episodes and because of the nature of the illness, it drops really like extremely. And especially in terms of language and verbal memory. These drops, I think verbal memory goes from about an average of 115 IQ in verbal in verbal ability to something like 85 average in this particular one. So that's the most stark and most unbelievable drop. Mm. So essentially, like, my research is trying to find out, like, what can we do to try and help that, and also trying to increase awareness around that, around the fact that, you know, although we have pre-morbid, what they call pre-morbid, which is quite a harsh word, to be honest. Morbid sort of suggests it's sort of death, but it's the word they use anyway. But pre-diagnosis or pre-problem, high cognitive ability, but the dramatic drop needs to have more awareness that we know, and try and focus on how do we improve that so that people are able to function again, and people are able to live the life that they want and to pursue their dreams. I guess that's the main thing that I'll come from in terms of that. So that's that. In terms of me and my own journey, I'd say I've been very stable for a long time now. I had a very big test a couple of years back with, you know, I was engaged, my relationship fell through. And you know, my sister was very ill again at that time, and at the same time I had exams and a very stressful job, and it was very intense, very, very intense all at the same time. And I managed to use the strategies which I sort of learned over that period of time, and managed to come out without having a proper episode. To say that I wasn't unstable at the time isn't accurate, but there's a difference between feeling like unstable and having an episode, you know.
Yes.
Feeling unstable is a human thing, like, yeah. You know, we all feel unstable sometimes, but there's for a sure. big difference between that and having an episode,
for sure.
So but yeah, for a number of years now, probably, you know, a good five years no episodes, you know. So I think it's been quite a good journey in recent years.
Good Thank you for all of your time and for this wonderful conversation. I've thoroughly enjoyed talking to you and getting to know you a bit better. Where can everyone find you on socials? Where can we find you?
I mean, to be honest, the place that I'm most at is on LinkedIn. You know, my name is Samuel Swazinski. You know, you can find me on Instagram at Winning the War Within, and Twitter, Sam Swazinski as well.
Okay.
So you know, and I do my own podcast as well. It's Winning the War Within, which is what so that's sort of my podcast. And then you know, I sort of took the title, it was quite similar to my book, so I decided to sort of do it under that name. So yeah, that's just sort of where you can find me.
Amazing. Sam, thank you. Genuinely, I've loved talking to you, and I'm really grateful for your time in this space.
No worries at all. I mean, it's great. I mean, I enjoy talking about bipolar always, but it's nice to talk to someone who has it, but also has like a deep understanding of how to get better as well.
Yeah, thank you very much. Well, I'm trying.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Let's Talk Bipolar, the podcast brought to you by Bipolar UK. Please go to our website, www.bipolaruk.org, for all of our resources and all of the support that we can offer you.